let's not further it here. We have received few apologies. Where are those apologies? So that we record them. Okay. Honorable Ethan Swart and Mr. S.A.F. Murray. We also received an apology. Which one is it? This is a standing apology of Dr. Luyenge because he's out of the country. So these are the three apologies that we have received. Other than that, we expect everybody to be here. We are here to process the GEPF Amendment Bill. And I will then explain later on what the committee should actually consider moving forward. For now, I would want to hand over to the team from National Treasury. You'll introduce yourself. And we'll be led from your side. Thank you.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members of the Committee, and thank you very much for the opportunity this morning to have the opportunity to come and respond to some of the submissions that were received by the Committee in relation to the Government Employees Pension Law Amendment Bill, and also to provide some responses to some queries that some of the members of the committee have raised in respect of the bill, so that hopefully we can provide some further clarity on some of the concerns that have been raised in the committee. I'm Janine Bednar-Diose. I'm the Director of Legislation in the National Treasury, and I have my colleagues here, Jolene Moodley from the GEPF and Esti DeWitt from the Government Pensions Administration Agency. One particularly important concern that was raised by the committee in its previous deliberations was they were requesting some further detail regarding the costing of the revised NSF pension dispensation and how the potential costs were assessed. So we're endeavoring to provide some additional information which will hopefully assist the committee. It has been estimated by the actuary of the GEPF that the amount of additional liability that would be owed to the GEPF by the various government departments and institutions in relation to the revised NSF pension dispensation would be $4.735 billion, and as at December 2010. In order to maintain the fund's funding requirements, the board of the GEPF has requested that in respect of members who have already exited the fund, that a lump sum payment of 1.378 billion rand would be made as per calculations that have been made by the GEPF actuary. And therefore, the GEPF would require a cash injection of 1.378 billion rand in order to provide for the payment of lump sum benefits to members who have already exited the GEPF. And just going a bit further into how the financial implications were assessed and determined, the GEPF provided data in respect of all of the 23,250 members, and the various details indicated on the slide were provided in relation to all of those members. And then the cost was assessed based on the current list of employers provided by the GPAA, and it is possible that the cost may change somewhat in the future as more members come forward who qualify for NSF service or if the employer on record is incorrect. And so they calculated the total number of active members at 31 December 2010, and the cost involved in changing the dispensation was calculated as being the difference between the actuarial interest a member receives based on his pensionable service, including the additional non-statutory forces service that the member would be entitled to receive, and the actuarial interest a member receives based on his pensionable service, excluding any non-statutory forces service that the member would be entitled to receive. And then they calculated the exits as at 31 December 2010, and the cost involved in changing the dispensation was calculated as being the difference between the benefits that a member receives, depending on the exit reason of the particular member, based on his pensionable service, including the additional non-statutory forces service that the member is entitled to receive, and the benefits that a member receives, depending on the exit reason of the particular member, based on his pensionable service, excluding any non-statutory forces service that the member is entitled to receive. And then those results were accumulated with appropriate interest from the particular date of exit of each member to 31 December 2010. And the interest was then calculated as follows. That to look at short-term interest, it was calculated looking at the cost of the date of exit, was accumulated with late payment interest in accordance with the late payment interest rate policy of the GEPF to 30 March 1998. And then market-related interest, to determine that, it was estimated that the funds backing the GEPF earned an investment return in line with the growth of the National Portfolio Index, or NPI, and the cost was accumulated with investment returns approximated by the NPI from 30 March 1998 until 30 September 2010. And then short-term interest was calculated looking at late payment interest in accordance with the late payment interest rate policy of the GEPF, and that was added from 1 October 2010 to 31 December 2010. So that's how all the various appropriate aspects of interest were determined. And then the next slide provides sort of an overall summary of the various costs for both the Department of Defense and an accumulated amount for all other departments, and then total cost. So there's the number of members. So there's a total of 23,250 members who...
Can you speak into the mic?
Oh, sorry. Thank you. So the total number of members involved is 23,250, and the vast majority of those are in the Department of Defense, 19,669, and in all of the other departments, there are 3,581 members. And then the cost of exit is then indicated as at 31 December 2010, and excuse me, so that is 2,727.72 billion, and for all other departments it's 989.70 million, and for the total it's 3,717.42 billion. The cost for active members as at 31 December 2010 is 2,759 billion for the Department of Defense. For all other departments, it's 914.25 million, and the total is 3,673 billion. And the total cost is 5,486 billion for the Department of Defense, and for the other departments, it's 1,903 billion, and the total is 7,309 billion. And then the The amounts that have already been contributed by employers is deducted, and also the reserve account balance for NSF past discriminatory practices. And so the total remaining cost is $3.982 billion for the Department of Defense, $752 million for other departments, and a total of $4.734 billion for the overall cost. That's how the overall estimated financial implications was arrived at. And looking at addressing the financial implications, the reimbursement of the GEPF for the additional liability arising out of the revised NSF pension dispensation is dependent on the appropriation of funds by Parliament. And appropriate submissions are being made to the Minister's Committee on the Budget this year to ensure that appropriate appropriation allocations would be included in the 2012 MTEF allocations in the forthcoming budget. And it is intended, certainly, that departments would end up receiving the necessary allocations to be able to cover their liabilities to the GEPF in accordance with this revised NSF pension dispensation. However, it is noted that the National Treasury will also conduct an appropriate actuarial diligence exercise to ensure that the costs are appropriately verified, and this process is already underway, and the GEPF and National Treasury are engaging in ensuring that all of the relevant documentation is available and assessed to ensure that the appropriate diligence exercise is able to be undertaken. Now, I'd like to turn to some of the issues that were raised in the various submissions that have been provided to the committee in relation to the bill. And the first submission that I'd like to look at is the submission by the Commission on Gender Equality. And the key recommendation in the submission by the Commission on Gender Equality is proposing that a definition of spouse be included in the bill in order to ensure that all of the various types of relationships, including civil unions and religious marriages, would be covered by the bill and will be able to have the benefit of the application of the clean break principles. And a similar query was raised in the previous briefing meeting on the bill about ensuring that, you know, the bill will cover all of the necessary types of relationships, and it was queried whether potentially a definition of marriage might need to be included in the bill. It's relevant to note that the government employees pension law does not currently contain a definition of spouse or marriage, and the rules of the GEPF, however, do contain a definition of spouse. And I'll refer to that definition a little bit later. The Divorce Act of 1979 does not include a definition of marriage or a definition of spouse, although the Act does refer to the dissolution of marriage, and it also uses the term spouse in the Act. So the Divorce Act, you know, does not utilizes these terms but does not clearly define those terms in the context of divorce and the divorce orders that may be granted in terms of the Act. So that's an important aspect relating to the legislative framework that's applicable here. In relation to civil unions, the Civil Union Act of 2006 does not specifically address the dissolution of civil unions. However, Section 13 is very important to consider as it addresses the legal consequences of a civil union. And Section 13 provides as follows. So I've set that section out there for purposes of reference for the committee. And essentially, that section provides that in essentially all other legislation, a reference to marriage should be interpreted to include a civil union, and that a reference to a husband, wife, or spouse in other legislation should be interpreted to be also include a civil union partner. So then, when we look at the wording in the Divorce Act, references to the dissolution of a marriage should also be interpreted to include a civil union, and the procedures that are provided for in the Divorce Act in relation to the dissolution of marriages and the granting of decrees of divorce would also apply to civil unions. And there's also been a recent court case in the Western Cape that has confirmed this interpretation. And the court found that a same-sex marriage or partnership concluded under the Civil Union Act was capable of dissolution in terms of the Divorce Act. And as a civil union partnership is essentially fully recognizable as a marriage, whether it's termed a marriage or a civil union, and that union is capable of dissolution in terms of the procedures under the Divorce Act. And then in relation to the dissolution of customary marriages, the Customary Marriages Act of 1998 in Section 8 specifically deals with the dissolution of customary marriages and makes the procedures provided for in the Divorce Act specifically applicable in relation to the dissolution of customary marriages. And I've included the relevant provisions of Section 8 in the presentation for your reference. And it clearly indicates in Section 8, Subsection 4, that a court has the powers contemplated in terms of Section 7, 8, 9, and 10 of the Divorce Act, so that includes the powers to make court orders dissolving a dissolution of a customary marriage. And so then those processes provided for in the Divorce Act are applicable to customary marriages. So, in conclusion, in light of how the Civil Union Act and the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act already provide for the application of the Divorce Act and the procedures relating to the granting of divorce orders to civil unions and customary marriages, then the manner in which the Government Employees Pension Law Amendment Bill provides for the application of the clean break principle in relation to orders for the divorce or for the dissolution of a customary marriages also apply in relation to civil unions and customary marriages. The one type of relationship which is highlighted by the Commission on Gender Equality, which is more complicated to deal with in terms of legislation, is as a spouse in terms of a religious marriage. And in other legislation, the recognition of those relationships and the manner of their dissolution is not really appropriately and clearly established, and that's one reason why there have in recent times been moves to develop a specific piece of legislation to deal with those types of marriages. It is notable that the Pension Funds Act does include quite a broad and appropriate definition of spouse, and I've set out the definition there, which also includes partners in civil union relationships, customary marriages, or a marriage in terms of the tenets of a religion. And already in terms of the rules of the GEPF, the spouse is also defined in a similar manner to how it is defined in the Pension Funds Act, and it is also defined to include customary marriages, civil unions, life partners, and also partners in, or marriages according to the tenets of any religion. And so spouses in terms of all of those types of relationships are capable of being registered with the fund, and they are able to, then the rules also apply to them. Now, one rather complicated aspect that arises in relation to the application of the clean break principle is that the way that the clean break principle is applied is that, you know, there is a decree for the dissolution of the relationship that is provided to the fund, and then the fund then is able to act upon that court order and also to then apply the clean break principle. And so that is quite easily dealt with for the civil unions and customary marriages. But with respect to the religious marriages, there is a complication because currently the Divorce Act does not appropriately define spouse. And so, and also, it's not appropriately addressed in some of the other legislation. So then spouses in terms of religious marriages currently aren't able to formally obtain a court order for a decree dissolving that marriage. And so that does provide complications in relation to the application of the clean break principle to those relationships. And there is clearly a need in relation to the Divorce Act that ambiguity and should be appropriately addressed, and it's hoped that this will be done in the future. But we the National Treasury would support the inclusion of an appropriate definition of spouse in the bill, and the rules of the GEPF have already defined spouse in those terms to try as far as possible to appropriately apply the rules to all of the various types of relationships. The next submission that I'd like to discuss is the submission by the Cape Bar Council. And the key proposals that have been raised by the Cape Bar Council is that the bill could be potentially improved by incorporating, by reference in the bill, provisions of the Income Tax Act, so that the question of how the tax that would be payable on any amount to be assigned to a non-member spouse from a member's benefit would be referred to as set out in Section 37D, Subsection 1, Paragraph D2 of the Pension Funds Act. And that provision, as set out in the presentation, empowers the fund to deduct from the pension benefit any amount that may be due in tax. It is also recommended that other sections in Schedule 2 of the second schedule to the Income Tax Act should also be specifically incorporated by reference in the bill. And those provisions, which are also set out in the presentation, specifically provide for, in relation to pension funds registered in terms of the Pension Funds Act, how deductions are dealt with in relation to Section 37D of the Pension Funds Act. And so those provisions are set out there. Now, it's important to note that the current wording, particularly of the provisions in the second schedule of the Income Tax Act, do not currently appropriately cater for the Government Employees Pension Fund. And it will be necessary to make amendments to the Income Tax Act in order to provide appropriately for the Government Employees Pension Fund, as it will be amended by the bill to provide for the clean break principle. The National Treasury's view is that it is important that tax amendments generally and all tax matters should generally be addressed in the specific taxation legislation and should not be addressed in other legislation except where absolutely necessary. And so it's our view that these amendments should be addressed in the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill and not in this bill. And the requirements will be drafted this year and will be included in the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill for 2012. And to the extent deemed necessary, it can be provided for the retrospective application of those amendments. And it is important that there be appropriate provisions in the tax legislation that specifically cater for the GEPF and how the clean break principle relates is applied in terms of the GEPF, because there are additional complications such as how the application of Formula C, the pre-1998 tax-free portion in the case of certain former GEPF members would be dealt with. And also, because a lot of the manner in which the provisions relating to Section 37D are crafted, they're not specifically tailored to the application in the defined benefit fund that is the GEPF, which has some particularities which differ from other funds. So it is very important that there be appropriate provisions in the Income Tax Act that really clearly and specifically address the needs of the GEPF, and it would not be desirable from our perspective to incorporate reference and the application of some of these provisions in the Income Tax Act by reference that they apply mutatis mutandis with appropriate changes to the GEPF, which is the approach which is supported by the Cape Law, Cape Bar Society. And because that sort of reference of other provisions applying mutatis mutandis has the potential to introduce some degree of uncertainty in how these provisions of the Income Tax Act would apply in relation to the GEPF, to the extent that those provisions are not appropriately catering for the needs of the GEPF. So therefore, our view is that it will be preferable to address these issues in amendments to the Income Tax Act in the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, and to ensure that the very specific provisions are included that will appropriately and clearly address all of the income tax matters relating to the clean break principle. And this will avoid any potential unintended uncertainty or ambiguity as to how the income tax will apply in relation to the payments made by the GEPF in terms of the clean break principle. We just briefly would like to touch on the submission by Ms. Molefe, which was received yesterday. And Ms. Molefe has submitted in her submissions that the GEPF should be guided by any settlement agreement that a former couple may have signed when their marriage was dissolved by a court, and provided that the member of the GEPF would have submitted a copy of that settlement agreement to their HR department. If a couple agreed that a former spouse should not benefit at all from a pension interest, or that they should benefit to only a specific proportion, that agreement should be honored. And the submission is made that the government employee's pension law should not specify the pension interest percentage to be paid to the former spouse, or to specify that the former spouse should benefit on the pension interest. If an agreement is entered into between former spouses regarding a settlement on divorce, and that agreement might include the manner in which the pension interest is to be dealt with, then that agreement could be endorsed and be made an order of court when a decree of divorce is granted in terms of the Divorce Act. And if such a settlement agreement is made part of the court order, that court order would determine, you know, whether any portion of the pension interest should be paid over and what proportion of the pension interest the former spouse would be receiving. And in those circumstances, the GEPF would be bound to act in accordance with any settlement agreement that was made in order of court, and determine the amount of pension interest to be paid in accordance with that court order and that settlement agreement. It is noted, however, that if the settlement agreement is not made an order of court, then it would not be legally bound in the same way. But provided the spouses do enter into the agreement and it is made an order of court, then that agreement does bind the GEPF in how the pension interest is dealt with. So the bill is not intended and does not require the GEPF to determine the payment of a pension interest to a former spouse, contrary to what may have been agreed in terms of a settlement agreement that had been made in order of court. It is just saying when a court order is provided to the GEPF that provides that a portion of the pension interest must be paid over, and that was agreed to for potentially in terms of a settlement agreement, then the GEPF must then determine the amount in accordance with that court order and the manner set out in the bill. So the bill is essentially setting out how the GEPF goes about implementing those court orders. It's certainly not empowering the GEPF to go and do something that has not been made an order of court. So for spouses that enter into agreements and those are made an order of court, then those agreements would certainly be honored. Just lastly, in relation to the submissions, we just noted this morning that a submission has been received from Ms. Nambulelo Fanny, and we note that this submission does not seem to directly relate to the bill itself, but it is a matter that certainly the GEPF will give its attention to. Finally, we just wanted to provide a few further submissions regarding preservation, as this was an aspect that was discussed quite a bit in the last briefing, and it is certainly a very important matter. So just to provide, you know, a bit of clarity about what is preservation and what it involves, preservation is providing a requirement that money saved for retirement through a pension fund or a provident fund should remain in such a preservation or provident fund until a person retires, or should be rolled over into another similar retirement savings vehicle, such as another preservation fund, without incurring taxes or penalties when a person changes jobs. So it's essentially trying to ensure that people keep their retirement savings to be used for their retirement and do not go and spend them earlier and then find that they don't have a satisfactory retirement savings. And, you know, looking at why there have been concerns recently about the lack of preservation that has been occurring, preservation is currently available and applicable in the retirement savings space, but it is currently voluntary and quite a few people actually exercise this option. And a recent study has shown that, you know, something like 70% of members seem to take their full pension benefits in cash when they leave an employment. And the lack of mandatory preservation results in leakages caused by payments to members leaving pensions and provident funds when they change jobs, are retrenched, or payments made to non-member spouses in cases of a divorce order. And this would ultimately translate to employees ending up not having sufficient income upon retirement, and this then leads to an increased Social Security burden and adversely can affect long-term economic growth. Due to a lack of mandatory preservation for occupational pension funds, there have been, as was noted in the previous meeting, some cases of individuals resigning from their jobs or getting divorced to be able to access all of their savings from pension and provident funds. And it is an important aspect that government is looking at and planning to address. And in the 2011 budget, the introduction of mandatory preservation has been mooted. And the introduction of this system would mean that pension and provident fund members exiting funds on the basis of retrenchment or when changing jobs would not have access to all of their accumulated retirement savings. Non-member spouses entitled to a portion of the pension benefit in terms of a divorce order would also be encouraged to preserve. And this measure is proposed in recognition of the need to protect retirement savings from being squandered due to a lack of foresight and long-term planning when members leave employers to retire or become divorced. Now, The National Treasury has been seriously looking at the implementation of preservation and how it should be appropriately implemented. And we are currently engaging and examining and engaging on how to appropriately implement preservation and what would be appropriate preservation requirements for pension payments on divorce. For instance, should there be a total prohibition on access to the pension payment, or should all of it be required to be preserved, or should there be some limited access to the pension payment? This is an important consideration that has to be made. And once this has been appropriately examined, considered, and engaged upon, the National Treasury will undertake a consistent legislative form that will be applicable to all pension funds, including the GEPF. We have seriously considered about the potential imposition of preservation right immediately in relation to the GEPF, but concerns are that if this is made an immediate requirement in the GEPF, while appropriate legislative reform has not already also been made to all of the funds regulated under Section 37D of the Pension Funds Act, which permits cash payments to be made to former spouses, it's quite likely that there would be court challenges, that this would be a discriminatory practice to former spouses of members of the GEPF who urgently seek access to their pension portion as cash. And in this regard, the case which was brought by Ms. Visa in the Western Cape High Court regarding the discriminatory practice about non-implementation of the Clean Break Principle, our understanding is that one of the important motivations for bringing that application is that she wanted access to her pension payment, you know, so that she could have access to the cash. So it's quite possible, you know, there would be court applications that would be brought by people who are wanting access to their cash payment because they know that other former spouses of members of pension funds made under the Pension Funds Act are able to access cash payments and then they're prohibited from that. So they would view that as being discriminatory. So that is an important concern that we've needed to take into account. It is therefore important that preservation be implemented consistently for all of the pension funds at the same time, and we are looking at implementing that legislative reform quite promptly. One other aspect that we just wanted to briefly address is in relation to the application of the transitional provision, which is in Clause 6 of the bill, in section which would include a new Section 33A into the Act. And some queries have been raised about, you know, is the current wording of that provision potentially broader than may be desirable and might unintentionally permit certain other applications to be made that, you know, really should not be reopened or addressed, need to be addressed again. So we've been examining particularly the wording of subsection 2 of that clause, and we have examined the appropriate scope of that provision, and we may propose to the committee for consideration is that the wording could be amended slightly to clarify that the intended scope is only in relation to applications relating to the application of the Clean Break Principle in terms of Section 24A. And so the proposed wording that we would propose is that the subsection could read as follows: any claims or applications that may have previously been rejected and finalized in terms of this law prior to the commencement of Section 24A of this law may be resubmitted for consideration in terms of this law and amended in accordance with the rules. So we think that perhaps that would ensure that only those matters relating to the clean break principle would be captured in terms of this subsection, so there wouldn't be the potential to capture other types of applications for claims in terms of other aspects of the GEP law or the rules. And also, we would just highlight that if, in relation to the divorce matters, if a divorce matter has already been finalized and a member has already exited the fund, then the former spouse would be eligible to receive that, would already have been eligible to receive that payment, and that payment would be made, and so that matter would be completely finalized, and there, so there would be no potential for those matters to be reopened in any way in terms of this subsection. This subsection is only intended to address those, to enable the GEPF to address those divorces which are already noted and endorsed on the system, but they weren't able to be paid out as yet because of the inability to apply the clean break principle. And then now the GEPF would be able to then address those existing matters appropriately and finalize them in accordance with the Section 24A. Esti, would you? Okay. So I think at this point this covers our submissions, so we can certainly take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, let me just remind ourselves as to what we had agreed to in the last meeting of the committee. First, we had said it will be important to receive public hearings or oral presentations. Subsequent to that, we did go out and invite the public to make submissions, those who want to do oral or written submissions. We received four submissions, written submissions, and none of the four wanted to make oral presentations to the committee. As a result, I then decided that it will be in the interest of the committee to take, otherwise this week we're not going to have anything as a committee. And as we move towards the next quota or session of Parliament when we come back, we are going to have quite a robust session. It will be important that we deal with the business that we could dispose of as of now, rather than to pile up our work for the next round of parliamentary business. So we thought it would be important to take a report back from National Treasury, GEPF, of which their presentation covered the responses of the written submissions, because we also submitted those submissions to National Treasury to look into the issues raised. And the bulk of their presentation is covered those written submissions that we have received and circulated to your good self, honorable members. So I thought I should just explain so that there's no confusion as to why this particular route. And I thought it would be important that we use this opportunity to receive and engage with the responses, and beyond that, as a committee manager, to sit and reflect and do some deliberations and see if we cannot take this piece of legislation or amendment forward as quickly as possible. Now, having said that, I thought I should present and I should allow honorable members an opportunity to engage with the submission that has been made by our presenters, and I must thank you for such an elaborate responses. Sitting here, I was asking myself, shouldn't be a union be a voluntary matter that people should draft their own contract rather than to have ourselves as parliamentarians trying to regulate what two individuals or so would have agreed upon. But being public representatives, we have to make sure that we protect the interest of every citizen in every aspect of life. And this piece of legislation or amendment before us is all meant to do that. Honorable George, Honorable Mtetwa, Honorable Gorenwolf, you'll be followed by Van Rooyen, Madlamini, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the presentation from the National Treasury. Specifically on the costing, because that was an issue that I raised, I know it's not the easiest exercise to do, but I do see that you've done a good job on it, so thank you. One of my concerns, though, on the costing is that this is not a verified costing, that there are some pieces of work that still needs to be done on it. Specifically, you mention... I think, let's see a page. Looks like, no, there's no page. Yes, page 8, where it says the National Treasury will need to conduct an appropriate actuarial diligence exercise to verify the cost. So my understanding of this is that we actually don't know for sure what this will cost, although we've started going down the road. So that is a concern to me. But the question is, if this is going to be an exercise, then when will it be done? That's my question to the Treasury. But just a comment that I'd like to make is that I'm concluding here that we don't really know what the cost of this will be, and also that Treasury doesn't have the money to pay for this because Parliament will need to appropriate it. So that is also a concern. And then... on the taxation issue, i.e. who pays the tax and how it works, I do see that there is some commentary from the Cape Bar Council, and there's a response from Treasury that the Income Tax Act will need to be amended and that this will be done in 2012. But what happens in the meantime? I'm just quite concerned about that because it isn't clear, it seems. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. My concern is on Section 33A, Subsection 2. How far back are you prepared that this claim can be resubmitted? And did you anticipate the number of such claims and the cost thereof? Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just on preservation, I just want to ask, when do you foresee changes to the Pension Act, and should we not wait for that?
Chair, maybe since most of the, all of my issues have been covered, I must take this opportunity to really comment the women-only team from Treasury. I mean, for the work that they have done. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just need a clarity. Thank you from the Treasury. But I'm sitting here, if you go to page 4 of your presentation, and I'm asking myself if we were to be taken to court for this Act, and the judge finds itself not understanding some issues because I am failing to understand them right now. You know, you look at the calculation of the financial implication. Honourable George has just touched, you know, just the top of it. But I just want to understand. You are saying here is the methodology, for calculating the actual interest, right? And you are saying, as you're going to be busy calculating this, it would be just you'll be using the difference between an individual member with additional non-statutory force services with that one with excluding a member with a non-statutory services. What is the difference? What factor is that? Because when you calculate, it's either you say you minus something to something or you add something, there should be a formula. And I don't find this formula here. Now, how then the judge is going to arrive and say, indeed, the methodology used and the formula used is fair and just, so I then give this judgment. If you can just, you have gone along, even when you were trying to give us the methodology regarding the exit, as whatever, and you look at the database that you have requested from individual members, which does give some understanding that yes, indeed, you'll have some information, that is the date when the member joined and the date when the member exit and the reason why he exits. That is the data that you're going to use. But where is the formula? How are you going to get the difference? What are you going to do? Are you going to say a date minus this equals to that? Then you are able to arrive at the cost. Then I've got a problem with that. Even if you go down to the, when you calculate the short-term interest, it's a bit ambiguous. It's very ambiguous. Just because now I'm looking at this as a law now. I mean, it's a tool that is being used by the court, but it still remains ambiguous. Then it questioned the people that actually took this and to the parliament and make it a legislation. I don't know if you understand. Do you, if I hope you will. That's why I've got a problem. And then I do agree with Mrs. Molefe that depending on the terms and the conditions of a decree, I mean, depending on the terms, if I divorce my husband and then I say take whatever that you owe, I'm going to take my children and my suitcases. I don't need anything. I mean, it's a contract. I think I also agree with it. Talking about the tax references, I'm assuming that the income tax. I'm assuming that references are to be made. But indeed, we cannot make amendments of tax, whatever tax issues on a different bill. It only a reference has to be made. If a case is sitting there, a reference has to be made to a relevant act. Thank you, Chair.
Over to you. You'll share the questions amongst yourselves. Justify your presence here.
My colleague Laurel Shipilana will first address some of the questions relating to the costing aspects and the financial implications.
Morning. Sorry for being late. On the first question of not having verified the costs, the arrangement according to the CAB memo that approved the new NSF dispensation was that the Minister of Defence, GPF, and the Minister of Finance would enter into a payment arrangement to fund this new dispensation. Given the pressures of this group that qualifies for this new NSF dispensation, we found ourselves having to pay with immediate effect. The GEPF had advanced most of the funds to the Government Pension Administration Agency to start making payments. So the payments are currently being made, and in trying to find out what the current payments and the future payments that we're going to make, how much exactly will that cost the state, we requested an estimate from the GEPF in terms of the funds that they're advancing. And the 4.7 billion that we see in front of us, that's what they had estimated. And in accordance with the Treasury regulations, National Treasury has to verify any amount that it agrees to refund anyone. So we are in the process of commissioning an actuarial exercise, but by a third party who's not involved in this to maintain some objectivity. So the exercise will be conducted around the 1st of October, so it will take us plus minus 8 weeks, so we should have the final costing by December. But the difference is that only it will be minor changes, because remember, an NSF is a pension that we are extending to non-statutory forces. So it will depend on the MK database that says Mr. X served 20 years as a member of the MK. Therefore, the GEPF will apply their rules in terms of how much for 20 years you qualify for how much in terms of the percentage of the pension. So the costing will, the methodology won't change that much. It's just to verify the databases that we got from the Department of Defense for non-statutory members, AKA APLA and the Umkhonto we SIZO, and then to verify again the formula that will agree to use with the GEPF in terms of how the payment will be implemented for those that are still in service. And then on the question of not having the money to pay, when Cabinet approved this new NSF dispensation, it was aware that the government does not have this money. And I think the agreement was that it would be a direct injection from the Fiscus, which is the National Revenue Fund, and therefore Treasury has agreed to centrally budget for the entire cost of NSF instead of saying to each department that employs an NSF member to refund the GEPF. It would be very chaotic if we did it that way. So we are going to budget for the funds ourselves. We started budgeting for them in July when the 2012 MTEF budget process commenced. We closed the databases 2 weeks ago, and we have budgeted for the 4.7 billion to refund the GEPF, but a repayment arrangement to be entered into for a period of 5 years, because the Fiscus cannot carry the burden of a once-off repayment. So, but it will follow the normal budget process. It will go to the Minister's Committee, it will come to Parliament to be appropriated. If approved by Cabinet again, the funds will be available next year after the budget speech, like any other funds for government. There was a third question on... No, it was not for me. Thank you.
You didn't tell us who you are.
Oh, my name is Laurel Shipalana from National Treasury. I work in the Civil and Military Pensions Division.
Okay. There are still questions that need to be answered. Yeah, let's allow them to answer.
Honourable Chair, thank you. If I can just add to the costing on Honourable Mehdi's question with regards to the costing and the methodology and the difference between the with NSF and the out NSF. Remember that what is in the presentation is the methodology to explain this cost of what it will be to extend this pensionable
service dispensation of including NSF. NSF was not there before, so what this means is he's bringing in this dispensation, you adding pensionable service years to people who qualify for this NSF dispensation. And remember that the GPF is a defined benefit fund, so all benefits are calculated in accordance with set formulas set out in the rules of the GPF. So when they explain the methodology of calculating what this will cost, and when they explain the difference between the actuarial interest with NSF and the actuarial interest without NSF, that NSF is a portion, is a factor that is part of the formula of actuarial interest. So the portion of that factor is the pensionable service. So you'll take the formula and you'll apply the pensionable service period of someone that is without the NSF pensionable service period. You will take that same formula and take the pensionable service where you add the NSF the pensionable service period, and then it will give you two total amounts of what those benefits would then be and the difference between those two, because you've added pensionable service years on the one and not on the other, is then the methodology used to calculate what it will now cost because I'm adding these additional pensionable service years under the NSF dispensation.
Okay. Chairperson, I'll answer the question raised by Honorable and Tetua in terms of how far back do we have clean break members that will be impacted by clean break on the system. I think what we need to understand that in 2007, when the Pension Fund Act allowed for the clean break implementation, since that time, the GPF, once we receive divorce orders, we endorse against the members' account. And as far as I can remember, in terms of our last calculation, we're sitting around 5,000 members currently that have come to the fund with a divorce order, in terms of wherein they have a non-member has a claim against the member's pensionable interest. So once the law goes through, we'll have to, that section 33A2 subsection 2 will allow us to immediately pay out those members, and then going forward to pay out as and when we receive a divorce order. So in terms of our system, we have around 5,000. It grows every month with around about 100 members that come forward with divorce orders, so but we are around 5,000 divorce orders on our system at the moment.
Thank you. Honorable members, are you quite comfortable with the rate of divorces? Okay.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Just to finally address a couple of the other queries that were made. In relation to the taxation amendments and how those would be implemented, the amendments and the manner in which it is intended that the pension payments would be addressed would be addressed in the tax proposals that would be tabled with the budget in February, and then they would be appropriately addressed in the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill in 2012, and the provisions would be drafted in such a manner to ensure that all of the various matters that will arise in terms of the new Section 24A will be appropriately and clearly addressed from a tax perspective, and will be made retrospective appropriately, to an appropriate date that we will carefully examine and ensure that it's addressed appropriately, the retrospectivity. In relation to the aspect of preservation and when we think that will be implemented, the preservation issue is certainly a very important matter that we're looking into and will be wanting to address on our legislative program. It will be something that we are going to be finalizing our legislative program for next year in the next couple of months, and so we will be engaging internally and obtaining final ministerial approval about when we will be able to develop and introduce the necessary pensions amendment legislation. So we will be engaging with colleagues, you know, regarding realistic time frames for the necessary engagement, but it is something that we will be working on to implement legislatively quite promptly, as we recognize it is a very important issue of concern that needs to be addressed legislatively. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable George, I saw you had your hand up.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for your responses. I just wanted to ask a follow-up question on the members that have already exited. Unless I'm misunderstanding, it sounds as if the fund has already made payments to people on the basis of past service and that the law is now just catching up. If that is the case, just indicate yes or no. Thank you.
Yes.
Answered? Okay. I think the costing is not just the financial aspect of the bill. Well, we take it, it might be that we are going to have some societal problems, or we already have a societal problem. If you look at the preservation fund issues, where anecdotal examples that are given here. And I think if we live amongst people, these things are happening already. Whether this is not a perverse incentive, as much as it is a right of a beneficiary in the form of a spouse. But to a certain extent, you do see an element of it becoming a perverse incentive. And its impact on the culture of savings, because pension funds are not just a fund, they are part of a pool of resources that in terms of the economy, is one of the biggest sides in the financial sector terms, its contribution in your financial market analysis and so on and so forth, or capital markets. What concerns me is the sustainability moving forward. Because your response says pending the approval of the Ministerial Committee on Budget on a year-to-year basis, this matter will be addressed. And I don't think we can pass a piece of legislation based on ad hoc arrangements. Unless I didn't understand you very well. I think the spirit of the legislation or of the bill is quite clear. The spirit is quite clear. But there are those issues that we may need to look into, you have to look into moving forward, which may need to be addressed to tighten, you know, the leakage within the system. I think we are a society that lives on credit, and we love that. We can't just come out of that. Which is not very, very helpful in terms of building the reserves and so on and so forth, and investment side of the economy. This is just my comments. You can respond if you feel like you're not obliged to.
In relation to, you know, the concerns about the leakages relating particularly to the preservation issue, we certainly share those concerns, and we certainly do desire to address, you know, that issue very, very promptly. So we will be looking to do so in legislation. We certainly agree with those sentiments.
I think also, Chairperson, it is a concern of the fund, and I think the committee had raised earlier around the need to train or inform our members around the importance of savings. And as a fund, we've taken that into account in terms of our communication strategy. And once this bill is passed, we're going to have to go back to the members to advise them now around the issue of the Clean Break implementation and also use that platform to inform them that it's best the non-member spouse uses preservation. So we're going to do that as an active drive. I think what we're trying to do here in the legislation is bring about the equity in terms of what's happening in the private sector, and with we're finding our members and non-member spouse not having the same benefit in the GEPF, but we do share the concerns of the committee around leakages and the problems there.
Honourable Judge.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to indicate my enormous discomfort. What seems to be happening on this fund is that very bad governance has happened here, because if payments have been made to members for past service, I mean, I agree with the principle that you want to create equity, and obviously there's a process that needs to be followed, but if the fund has not first had the rules corrected or the law amended, if they haven't done that first, then they actually have broken the rules that apply at the moment. And if that is the case, that is enormous concern, and then the fund would need to come here to explain why they did that, because it's not acceptable. And then is that related then to the need for the fund to amend the powers of the board to make rules? Because what may have happened here is that there was this process to remedy the past service issue, and then the fund did in fact implement it for some of the people. Possibly it then realized that, oops, we don't have a law, we can't do this, we can't make the rule because we don't have the power, so we have to amend the law, and here comes the law to this committee, which we're now looking at. But the fact is that people have already been paid. So what happens if we don't want to pass this law? You know, do we have a problem? I'm just confused. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, thank you. Yes, if I can respond to Honourable George's question. I think maybe there was a misunderstanding in the response. When the response was yes, the past service payments that have been made was past service payments in respect of the rules that was applicable at that point in time. If we go back, remember, this point in time, this is a new NSF dispensation, implying that prior to this there was an existing NSF dispensation, and prior to that there was no NSF dispensation. So if we go back to the situation where there was no NSF dispensation, people were paid in accordance with the rules of the GPF based on the normal rules of resignation, retirement benefit, whatever it might have been. Then the initial NSF dispensation was enacted in terms of the rules of the GPF, and only when those rules were enacted and the GEP law was at that point in time in 2004 amended to allow for that NSF dispensation, did payments in respect of that initial NSF dispensation take place. Currently, the rules of the GPF has been amended to allow for this new NSF dispensation, and it's all in terms of the powers of the board to indeed do make rule amendments for this NSF dispensation. The law amendment currently bill in front of this committee relates to NSF in as far as it entails a consequential amendment to the Special Pension Act, which is related to the NSF dispensation, but the details of the payments of the new NSF dispensation is in fact contained in the rules of the GPF, which has been passed with regards to due process. So there's no contravention of the rules or no payments being made with any rules not being in place. The previous dispensation's rules were in place, and therefore payments in respect of those rules were made in respect of the previous dispensation. The new dispensation's rules are in place, and therefore payments are made in respect of the new NSF dispensation based on those rules. In as far as the amendment bill relates to the consequential amendment of the Special Pension Act, you will recall at the previous presentation, we tried to explain that the initial NSF dispensation did not allow recognition of NSF service and such a beneficiary to be paid a special pension at the same time. Now, this is part of the change of this dispensation, that such a person will be allowed NSF service recognition, which is additional service years within the GPF, as well as to retain payment of special pension until he exits government service. And that is still being enforced at this point in time, that you cannot have both because this law amendment has not been passed. So only at the point in time where this bill is passed will that part of the new dispensation be enforced. With regards to the amendment with for the board to make rules, that specifically refers to making rules around the clean break principle, not around the NSF benefit. NSF benefit and the changes of those rules, which are benefit-related rules, are fully within the current rules of the GPF and the powers of the board. But because clean break is almost a change in the nature of the workings of the GPF, where benefits are only due and payable upon exit, we needed to bring in provision that the board can have the power to make rules for clean break, which is a change from the norm, in the sense that we are, remember, this is a DB fund, we are allowing a payment prior to the pension benefit being due and payable because the member has not exited. So that's where the need to change the powers of the board to make rules relate to the clean break principle. But in no manner has payments with regard to NSF been made without the proper rules or the law changes been effected.
Thank you. I think you're clarifying my confusion. So I just want to confirm again. On page number one, where we say that the GPF will require a cash injection of $1.378 billion for the payment of lump sum to members who have already exited, that payment has not been made. That's just the number that will need to be paid to the people who have been exited, but they haven't got the money yet. Is that correct?
Okay, maybe we should just differentiate with where the costing comes from. Some of the payments have been made because some people have exited, and remember, the new NSF dispensation, which allows for the fact that people who qualify for NSF, in the previous dispensation, you had to contribute 5% to have that service recognized, and people with less than 10 years NSF service only had 50% of that service recognized as NSF service. Part of the new dispensation is that you no longer need to pay the 5% member contribution, and people with less than 10 years service now has full NSF recognition. Those matters in respect of the new dispensation has already been amended in the GPF rules, and the board has got the power to make those amendments in the GPF rules. So in as far as that is concerned with regards to the new NSF dispensation, that is already being applied because the rules is capable of having been amended and has indeed been so, because the board has the power to do that. So some of the exited people who is in fact the group that is in need of having the new NSF dispensation applied because they're no longer working, they've exited employment, has indeed received their payment as a recalculated pension benefit because of either a 5% refund to such a person or the recognition of his full NSF service. Now, the cash injection and the costing of the NSF is something that emanates from Section 17 of the GP law, which indicates, remember now this is the GPF as a separate juristic pension fund, that if any action taken by Parliament or any bill passed causes an additional liability on the fund, then government needs to make good for it. So in the meantime, the GPF is indeed paying benefits in terms of the approved rules based on the new NSF dispensation, and the costing around NSF and the refunding of the GPF is then almost something that's catered for under the auspice of it's causing an additional liability to the fund. The fund is giving the benefit to the members and the ex-members, but we need to deal with the additional liability this is causing the fund and how government is going to refund the GPF in that regard.
product. Okay. Okay, honourable members, honourable speaker, welcome. We've just seen you now. Any input? Covered? Okay. Honourable members, I think we should really appreciate the information that we got from the team, all women-led team. I think you've done very well in terms of trying to clarify certain issues and your responses to the committee. As I have already outlined, honourable members, I think what we should then do is to check as to whether there are still any other substantive issues that we want to be cleared. If not, I would want us to move towards concluding our deliberations on the bill so that we can take the process forward in terms of parliamentary processes. And I'm sure Honourable Goranov will agree with me that this is not anywhere next to the complicated bill that we're dealing with in the past few weeks, the Information Protection Bill. This is about bringing about equity into the system, and already there are existing rules and regulations and a legal framework that is dealing with certain aspects that we may not be familiar with. But I think what we shouldn't do is to try to link everything with that which we are not yet familiar with at this point in time. Let's deal with what it is before us in terms of the piece of proposed amendments that is expected that this committee should deal with at this point in time. Agreed, honourable members, that we should take that route. Thank you. Can I have somebody proposing that we should, as a committee, adopt this proposed amendment?
Yes, Chair. With emphasis on key points, I mean, following from our discussions, the issue of the sustainability of the funding model, as well as the aspect of promotion of preservation. So I think those key points must come out as emphasis in our report. So I therefore move that we obviously approve the amended report or the recommendations.
Honourable George.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd just like to record that the DA would reserve its position. Thank you.
Noted. Honourable Goranov.
I do not foresee any problems to support, but just taking it finally to the study group, I should do that.
Thank you. Madlamin.
The ANC is seconding the adoption of the report.
Thank you. I think what we are saying as a committee, honourable members, and I'm going to read what we are agreeing on. Of course, as a normal practice, honourable members, when we go back to the House in terms of the debate of the legislation or the report itself, we'll be free to put our points across. But as a committee, we should move out here understanding that we've agreed with the proposed amendments as tabled to this committee by the National Assembly. I would therefore take this opportunity to read so that we all agree on what you have said. The Standing Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Government Employee Pension Law Amendment Bill, B15/2011, National Assembly subsection 75, National Assembly section 75 referred to it and clarified by the JTM as a section 75 bill, reports the bill without amendments. Agreed? Thank you. You are released in terms of our deliberations. And honorable members, thank you very much. We will try by all means to get this amendment. If certain rules have to be amended, we'll discuss with the programming committee and the office of the speaker so that before this parliament goes on short recess, we should have had this piece of legislation or bill processed through by the House. Thank you very much.
Get that report, but what do you do with the agreement?